Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once, or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley.
Boris Johnson is facing more questions about his future. Tory MP still not happy. But the weekend, the Prime Minister was asked by reporters in Rwanda whether he'd like to serve a full second term as Prime Minister. He replied, "At the moment, I'm thinking actively about the third. And you know what could happen then, but I'll review it when I get to it." All the way into the 2030s. A humorous deflection or a hubristic joke? It's all a bit like when Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair vowed to go on and on and on and on. Well, I've been speaking to Tory MPs from across the country and across the party spectrum over the weekend, because that's how I like to have fun, about the Prime Minister's prospects. We'll bring you the private, off-the-record thoughts of Tory MPs. And ask, is there any prospect of rebels winning as they try to force out Boris Johnson over and over and over again?
So that's coming up in our big thing in just a moment. First, as ever, we kick off with our columnist panel. And on a Monday is Libby Rachey, Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester.
The Columnists with Libby Rachey, Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester on Times Radio.
Yes, it's that time of the week. We always speak to two of our favourite columnists on a Monday. It is, of course, Libby Rachey. Morning, Libby.
Morning.
And morning to Rachel. Morning, Rachel.
Morning.
Let's start off by talking about the Tory party. We're going to do it a bit more a bit later on when we find out what Tory MPs off the record think. It feels like we're sort of slightly trapped in this circle of people are unhappy, maybe a few more people are unhappy. Everyone's hoping that someone else is going to do something. And in the meantime, he just goes onwards to 2030 and beyond, Libby.
Yes. Well, we were all joking last night saying, oh, wow, goodness, that's only about another 12 hours, you know, 2030 tonight. But no, it is, it's a problem in that I think the problem is not having any obvious successor around everybody, which everybody else will gather round, because they're all in little factions, you know, the Rishi faction and the others and the, you know, whatever, the Hunt faction. And I think this is why he's able just to go on. He is in this extraordinary privileged position. But I think Claire Foger's piece in the Times today is right. He is the Jeremy Corbyn of the Tory party. And the idea of somebody who lies and somebody who is in it, who wants the gold wallpaper, is such a dangerous thing for people to think about the Tory party that it will damage them for years.
And do you think it'll take as long? The Tory party need a sort of Keir Starmer. Maybe they do just need a dull person to replace him, Rachel.
Well, the point about Boris Johnson is his whole purpose for the Tory party was that he was a winner. And now what those by-elections have shown is that he's a loser and he's kind of repelling voters in the way that he used to once attract them. You know, he was that sort of Heineken politician who reached into the parts of the electorate that other Tories couldn't reach. But that sort of turned on its head, and all the kind of rule breaking that, you know, helped him to get to power has now sort of become his Achilles heel. And I think you're right, that sort of sense of decency that the Tories desperately need to be associated with and sort of competence, that they're in danger of losing that. And I spoke to one former cabinet minister recently who just said the problem is, it's, you know, Boris Johnson's always been a brand, his brand is trash, but the longer he stays there, the more he's going to trash the Tory party's brand. So there is this kind of acceptance among MPs that, you know, they probably need to get rid of him before the election just for the sake of their own survival. But they don't quite know when or how. But the longer he stays, a lot of them are beginning to think, the worse it's going to be for the party as a whole.
Is there a counter-argument which says that Boris Johnson, the fact that nobody else has managed to mount a case against him, or at least mount a successful challenge, even in the depths of as bad as things get, I mean, albeit before the by-elections, but most people assume they're going to lose the by-elections, he still won the vote of confidence. Is it not the case that maybe the moaners, his opponents, have just failed? And if they haven't got the balls to do something about it, they should shut up, Libby.
I think one of the problems is that he surrounded himself with yes men and with really not very talented people, with a few exceptions like Rishi Sunak and like, I think, Sajid Javid. He surrounded himself with some fairly poor people, and therefore there aren't senior people in the party standing up. You know, there's a lot of very good people on the back benches who never did get promoted. There's a lot of very good, quite senior people on the back benches who never did get promoted. And so it's quite difficult to found to start a coup, you know, have the men in suits come in and have a word with him, if all the closest men in suits are kind of not very good, you know, bit helpless. And the way they are being wheeled out onto the morning shows to defend the most indefensible things that he personally does or says is just extraordinary. And of course, once you've been wheeled out a few times to say those things, you're associated with them. And so, you know, it becomes more and more difficult to create a coup. If there's going to be a coup, it'll have to come from right up down the bottom.
And I suppose that's the problem, isn't it, Rachel? Is that a coup from the bottom is harder to mount?
Yes, although bear in mind that, you know, if Sir Graham Brady, the head of this sort of backbench committee, thought that there was a majority against the Prime Minister and he went and said that to Boris Johnson, then that would be pretty difficult for him. My main problem is that he has this, you know, he says he wants to go on until the third term, etc. But why? For what purpose? So apart from his own power. So you sort of wonder, he hasn't really got a reason to be Prime Minister, apart from just power and sort of having nice gold wallpaper and maybe building the £150,000 treehouse at Chequers. But what is his actual defining policy or purpose that's going to make a difference to the country? That's my biggest problem. And I think a lot of the Tory MPs are starting to think that as well.
I'm very glad you said that, Rachel, because I've been predicting for ages on this programme that, oh, he won't take much longer. He'll want to go. He'll pick a moment to say, oh, I led you through the pandemic. And now, you know, you're saviour of the world. I go off to make a lot of money for my ever increasing family. I've been thinking that for ages, but I do not know why he is still bothering.
Because I think he wants to be, he likes power. And he, you know, he wants to be, he sort of wants to be the person who's Prime Minister. But what I don't quite see is why he wants to be Prime Minister. What's the purpose apart from himself?
But then I suppose in a way, that's, you could say that's a reason for him to step down. But then if his only purpose is to carry on being Prime Minister, then he doesn't need to achieve anything. Every morning he gets up and if he's still Prime Minister, well, that's
exactly.
That's a win.
That's his purpose in his mind. But for the country, you sort of want it to be slightly better than that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know.
It was the treehouse, really. It was the treehouse. The fact this child is not yet two. He's only just two, I think. He's just turned two. I mean, it's some while before he'll want a treehouse. How long does he think he's going to have Chequers?
The treehouse story is extraordinary. So this is, as the Times revealed it on Saturday. I mean, the fact that it was going to cost £150,000. Boris Johnson planned to build a £150,000 treehouse in the grounds of Chequers.
And that's more than actual houses cost for actual people in some of the seats that the Tories won at the last election. I mean, it's just astonishing that you could think that's a good idea.
And inevitably, two sources said there were discussions about having Lord Brownlow, the man who ended up paying for the wallpaper, fund the project. Plans for the treehouse were drawn up, but it was ditched after Prime Minister's close protection officers warned of a security risk.
Not ditch because
get
it was
Lord
a bad
Brownlow
idea.
On.
Yeah, exactly. Not ditch was a bad idea. This was despite the fact. So the police said there was a security risk because you could see it from the road. It was going to have bulletproof glass, which increased the cost of the project significantly.
You're just unbelievable.
It is absolutely extraordinary. Somebody's just texted and saying, now Boris is talking about three terms, the treehouse is looking better value for money. I'm not sure it is. I think when they talked about, you know, the property ladder, we assumed it was to help other people buy a house, not the,
the
gold-plated ladder up to the treehouse. Exactly right. Let's turn our attention to the future of degrees. We talk a lot about education with you both on a Monday. And how graduate the English literature is being suspended as a degree at a university because of pressure from government to ensure graduates go straight into well-paid jobs. I was quite surprised by this because English literature, I mean, I always thought that history was the one that with the worst employment rate afterwards, you know, because people who couldn't think of anything else better to do went and did a history degree. I'd have thought English literature was reasonably employable, but apparently not, Rachel.
Well, as an English graduate, I can say that there is a value to it. And I think the problem is that the government actually has got itself into this muddle about university and higher education. And it's sort of the understanding the cost of everything and the value of nothing, that actually there is more to education than how much you earn and what kind of job you get. And so I do think it's incredibly important that people, you know, degrees do have value, but I think that's up to the people applying to those degrees. It's not up to the government to try and discourage universities from doing certain kinds of courses, which is what seems to be behind this decision to drop the literature degree. I think it sort of plays into this slightly wider government agenda, which is a bit hostile to the universities, that they, you know, universities are all about culture, you know, they're sort of launching this culture war and it's all criticizing Mickey Mouse degrees. Ministers seem to sort of use every opportunity they can to bash the universities. And in fact, it was David Willetts, the former universities minister and a Conservative peer himself, who said to us on the Education Commission that there is a suspicion that, some Conservatives think that graduates just don't vote Tory, so we don't want to make any more of them. Or his words to that effect. I'm slightly paraphrasing him. Yeah. But there is a sort of danger of a kind of wider political agenda here that's quite cynical.
What do you think, Libby?
Well, yes, I agree with everything Rachel says. It's absolutely true. But it's slightly ironic that in a world where sort of fast talking eloquence and, you know, persuading people seems to be one of the main industries and the main sort of ways people climb the ladder, that a literature degree, you know, which treats with language and the use of language and the impact of language, would be thought to be so valueless. And I had old school, totally old school English degree. I mean, I did Beowulf, you know, I did medieval poets like Scottish poets like Henryson, who I would never have approached otherwise. And approaching those, you know, it broadens a lot of things in your mind and in your thinking. And it made me, I remember in my sort of very first jobs after university, you know, my sort of junky jobs, it made me a better barmaid. You know, it made me a better telex temp at Gordon's Gin. You know, it furnishes something in your mind. And that should be a lot of what university is about, whatever. I mean, in some ways, yes, I wish I'd done engineering or chemistry or something sort of more physically useful, but I sort of tried to be useful in the ways I can be, and my mind has been maybe the more balanced for it. I don't know.
I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? Is there is this sort of tension between the value of learning in and of itself versus, well, if you're going to spend all that money and get into all that debt, then, you know, is it going to pay off in the long run?
They shouldn't be getting into all that debt. We should put a graduate tax on people of my generation who did well on free university degrees, my generation and the ones below. They shouldn't be in this big debt. That's wrong.
Rachel, last words?
Well, the other thing is that the way the government defines this kind of value is they look at what job you're doing 15 months after you graduate. Actually, I don't think that's an accurate way of measuring the value or success of a degree, that actually lots of people may take longer to get to the profession or job that they eventually want. But overall, a degree is shown over many years to have, for most people, a benefit, huge benefit, both in terms of what you earn and in terms of health, life outcomes, all of those kind of things.
Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester there, and of course you can read them in the Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, we speak to Tory MPs off the record.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast now. It's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
Yeah, let's go all the way back now. Just after the 1987 election, Margaret Thatcher gave an interview to the BBC in which she declared...
Yes, I hope to go on and on.
Didn't quite work out like that. Inflation rose to 10%, interest rates started rising, and then the Chancellor resigned. By 1990, she was out. I don't know if any of that sounds familiar to anyone looking at politics today. And then we jump to 2004. Tony Blair vowed to serve a full third term. In 2005, he won that third term in a landslide election. But by summer 2006, his critics were getting impatient. In September that year, he used an interview with The Times to insist, "I will not go on and on," but still refused to give a date. Within days, 8 junior members of his government resigned in a dramatic bid to force his hand. Now, only political nerds probably will remember that it was junior minister and supporter to Corner Brown, Tom Watson, and 7 ministerial bag carriers who quit. But Tony Blair's hand was forced, and then he publicly confirmed for the first time.
As for my timing and date of departure, I would have preferred to do this in my own way, but as has been pretty obvious from what many of my cabinet colleagues have said earlier in the week. The next party conference in a couple of weeks will be my last party conference as party leader.
Well, true to his word, the 2006 Labour conference was his last, and he left Downing Street in June 2007, 3 years earlier than he'd liked. So, is history now repeating itself? At the weekend, Boris Johnson was asked by reporters in Rwanda whether he'd like to serve a full second term as Prime Minister. He replied, "At the moment, I'm thinking actively about the third term, and you know what could happen then. But I will review that when I get to it." So he could be Prime Minister all the way into 2030 and beyond. A humorous deflection? A hubristic joke? Well, who knows? I've been speaking to Conservative MPs from across the country and across the party spectrum about the Prime Minister's prospects. That's how I like to spend my weekends. So as he continues his travels, what is the mood like back home? Well, the prospect of a third term going on and on and on into the 2030s has not gone down well. This was Tim Lawton, the Tory MP, on Times Radio yesterday.
I don't think it's very helpful. I think it could be construed as a little arrogant. And I seem to recall Mrs. Thatcher, when she was slightly on the ropes, talking about going on and on and on. I think what everybody wants to see is the Prime Minister concentrating on getting the first term back on track. And talk about planning for the future under his leadership is a distraction. We should be talking about future parliaments under Conservative governments, but not necessarily under the same person. So I'm not quite sure why he's done it, and it's not very helpful.
That was Tim Lawton on the record yesterday. But privately, the mood is even worse. So now we're going to bring you what people have been saying to me and others at the Times. Off the record, so we get their honest assessment, they don't want to be named. So we've put voices to the words. Our full team of RADA-trained actors have been voicing up what Tory MPs have been telling me about Boris Johnson's threat, joke, statement that he wants to go on and on to a third term. This is what one Red Wall Tory MP told me.
It is completely nuts pouring oil on the fire. Just when he should have shown some humility to the party and the country, he does the opposite. It winds people up. Who is advising him? I've had some colleagues saying that if we had a vote tomorrow, he would lose. I'm not so sure, but it feels so much more febrile after the by-elections than I expected.
Of course, that was those two by-elections happened last week. The Conservatives losing Wakefield to Labour and Tiverton and Honiton in Devon to the Lib Dems. Well, this is what one long-serving West Country MP told me.
He has lost the plot. Hard to know, but feel he'll be gone by year end or sooner. Opposition is spreading and deepening and is now likely to organise.
Yeah, it's really interesting that the idea that up until now, the opposition to Boris Johnson hasn't been organised. What about that threat to go on and on? This is what a former cabinet minister said.
It's very Boris making clear that he's going precisely nowhere. Extreme self-confidence that he can pull this around. Can he? Who knows?
A French Conservative MP there, voiced up by one of our colleagues here at Times Radio. And this is what a Tory MP in a Southern Lib Dem-facing seat said.
To say that comment is tin-eared and a red rag to MPs is the understatement of the year.
Tin-eared and a red rag to MPs. Well, did Boris Johnson even mean it? This is what one senior Tory backbencher told me at the weekend.
It's bravado. In practice, there'll come a point when the PM will want to go and do speeches and beaches. He'll earn millions. Had he lost the vote of confidence, he'd be richer than Gary Lineker.
Speeches and beaches, that's a very good way of putting it. So, those are the anonymous MPs giving us their views. Well, Boris Johnson tried to clarify his comments about going on and on when he was at the G7 summit in Germany yesterday.
This is a government that is getting on with delivering for people of this country, and we've got a huge amount to do. That's what I'm trying to get at. So, in the immediate future, we've got to get people through the current global inflationary pressures, the post-COVID Ukraine exacerbated inflationary pressures that people have got, the energy price spike that we've got. But at the same time, we've got a massive agenda of reform and improvement, a plan for a stronger economy.
That's Boris Johnson speaking at the weekend. On and on and on. Well, Willie, Stephen Swinford is the political editor of The Times and joins me live now from Westminster. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Matt.
So how serious is this moment? It's the Monday after those by-elections. It was pretty explosive, it felt, on Friday. How do you gauge his position today?
I think it's basically a situation of stalemate. So lots of people are very unhappy. You walk around Portcullis House here in Westminster, Matt, and you'll bump into loads of MPs who are really unhappy. And it's probably at the moment more than the 4 in 10 that voted to oust him from office. But at the moment, there's very little they can do about it. So all eyes in Westminster are now focused on the 1922 elections, which are due in a fortnight's time. And that's the body of that runs the kind of backbenchers, if you like. And that has the power to potentially call another confidence vote. It could only do so if the rules changed. So these elections are a kind of critical path on the way to changing those rules. And that is going to dominate a lot of the bandwidth here in Westminster for the next couple of weeks.
It's really interesting that. So basically, you need to get the 15%, 54 letters, triggered the vote of no confidence, what happened 3 weeks ago today. Boris Johnson won it. In theory, then, he's safe from challenge for another year. But this idea of pushing MPs who are critical of Boris Johnson to stand in the 1922 committee elections to change the rules has seemed to be taking hold. But not all MPs are convinced it's a good idea. This is what one former cabinet minister told me.
I'm still not sure that there are 180 who would vote against him. There are some very deluded MPs who have bought into the cult of Boris.
Well, could there be another vote of confidence this term before the summer recess? This Tory MP in a Lib Dem-facing seat isn't so sure.
Sadly, I think the pre-summer recess timetable is too tight to progress this. And yet again, he gets lucky. Number 10 will be just thinking about getting to recess. How tragic. And gives lie to the fact that he's really thinking about 2022, never mind 2035. Totally delusional.
And then this was what a Tory MP in the Midlands said about the idea of changing the rules.
There's a real danger in a loaded 1922 exec losing whatever authority it has to administer the party rules, so I hope we don't go down that line. Then again, Number 10 did try to get a friendly chair last year, so sauce for the goose.
Sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander. But that's a reference to an attempt last year to force out Graham Brady as chairman of the 1922 committee and replace him with the Number 10 loyalist Heather Wheeler. And this might all seem like we're disappearing into the weeds a bit here, Steve, but this is important.
The weeds matter because the weeds are what could ultimately do for the Prime Minister here and see him removed from office. At the moment, there are two potential ways of getting rid of him. One is if cabinet ministers decide enough's enough and turn around and tell him to go. Sitting here on this Monday morning, it doesn't feel like any of the cabinet that are still there are in that position. He looks like he's going to delay a reshuffle until the autumn. And I'm just not picking up anyone saying that he's got to go or saying that the rivals are ready to stand. That's not where we are. So if anything is going to happen, it's going to come from the backbenches. Now, this will take time. It will be contentious and it could be some months before anything actually happens in terms of a kind of tangible rule change. But what happens in the next couple of weeks could shape that. So that's what we're all looking out for. Will the 1922 committee be in a position to change the rules or not?
Well, I spoke to Sir Graham Brady, the chairman of the 1922 committee, a couple of weeks ago and asked him about the prospect of a rule change.
And it's not something that we as an executive have discussed at all in this parliament. There was a point in the previous parliament when those discussions took place at length. We ended up without changing the rule. I mean, it's right, obviously, I've reflected quite a lot on this because of the amount of speculation that's been in the media. It's a little bit like saying, well, you know, I haven't committed a crime of burglary, because Parliament might possibly change the law in the future. Now, of course, it is technically possible that laws can be changed in the future, and it's possible that rules can be changed in the future. But I think it's important we say that the rule that is in place and is likely to remain in place is that there is a year's period of grace following a confidence vote.
That was Graham Brady a couple of weeks ago. Then on Friday, Geoffrey Clifton Brown, who's on the 1922 committee, he pointed out there was an alternative to change the rules, and that was, as Steve Swinford was just explaining, getting the cabinet to rise up.
Well, there are two routes by which he could be persuaded to resign. One is by the whole executive of the 1922 committee having taken into account the wider views of the entire parliamentary party and then decide to change the rules. That is quite difficult, I think, to change the rules in mid-contest. Or the other way is for the majority of the cabinet to say that they have no confidence in the Prime Minister, in which case he would not be able to carry on. So I think there will be a lot of conversations taking place next week, and we'll have to see what happens.
But this is what the Environment Secretary, George Eustace, told Times Radio this morning.
I think the party generally has had that vote, has put it behind us, you know, for now, and they want the Prime Minister to really double down and address some of the challenges we've got in this country, and they want to give him the space to do that. And, you know, if we do that over the next year, 18 months, and we demonstrate that we've got on top of these post-pandemic challenges that the whole world's grappling with, well, then things might look very different.
The thing is, Steve, there's been a lot of talk over the weekend about the idea of cabinet ministers acting. But this feels like desperation a little bit. Let's just listen to Damian Green, who's obviously Theresa May's deputy. He was on Channel 4's Andrew Neil show last night, so almost begging cabinet ministers with leadership hopes to show their stripes.
If this long agony for everyone concerned, from the Prime Minister down, is to be brought to a head one way or the other, then maybe somebody in the cabinet might wish to take some action.
Is there anyone in the cabinet, obviously apart from Oliver Dowden, who did take some action on Friday, is there anyone who you're keeping an eye on, Steve?
At the moment, no. So the obvious candidate would have been Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, who was very diminished by the row over his wife's finances and tax affairs. So he's kind of at the moment focused on the cost of living and the measures to tackle that and kind of rebuilding. And the rest of the cabinet is almost slavishly loyal and holding out this threat of a reshuffle is actually a means of keeping them in line. So the moment he's done that, One, you end up with a load of people that were ministers on the backbenches being pretty irritated and cantankerous and potentially posing a threat to you. And two, you lose the threat of the reshuffle, which helps keep people in line. I'm just not picking it up, Matt, at the moment in terms of where people are. So the focus has got to be on the backbenches. And what's happening in Westminster today is a lot of those rebels are telling one another to get their letters back into Graham Brady. Even though it's symbolic, even though it can't trigger a leadership contest, their argument is that the more confidence letters that go into Graham Brady, the more pressure there will be for a change in the rules once the re-elections have taken place. So that's the focus of the rebels at the moment.
It's interesting, the thing that, speaking to Tory MPs over the weekend, the two things that sort of kept coming up was partly sort of partly exasperation that there weren't people, ministers, willing to take action, show some leadership. Actually, they wondered if it was, it sort of reaches a point where your inability to take action might count against you. This is what one MP who said privately they'd support an alternative leader, someone like Paddy Morton, but the refusal to act actually starts damaging them in the long run. This is what one of them said.
What I'd say to cabinet ministers who are not resigning is, when he does finally go, the people who wanted him to go for a long time will remember that you did nothing. There is a lack of leadership from those who aspire to it.
And then the flip side, Steve, is you've got actually a lack of leadership on the rebellion side as well. So many names, you know, Damien Green, who we just heard from, you know, if he was leading, it gets dismissed. This is what one MP said to me. They'll call it a Ramona plot, even though it isn't. So who is it? Is it Andrea Leadsom, Mark Harper, Steve Baker, Jeremy? Who, you know, Jeremy Hunt and Tom Tugendhat can't put themselves at the forefront of the efforts to oust him because they've all got leadership ambitions. Or maybe they should.
Yeah, I mean, they could well, Matt. I mean, realistically, it looks like if there was to be an alternative to leadership, it's probably going to come from within the cabinet. Nadeem Zahawi has kept his cards very close to his chest on that. He's been repeatedly asked, we've asked him, do you want the job of leader? And he just kind of dodges the question. Liz Truss is obviously another. So there will be candidates when that moment comes. But in this game, Matt, it often comes down to who wants it the most? Who in the government wants to be the prime minister? And there is no doubt that at the moment, the person that most wants to be prime minister and wants to continue doing that is Boris Johnson. All those examples that you played earlier on about Tony Blair, about David Cameron, even Theresa May, it got to a point when they were in a position that someone else wanted it more than them. They wanted the top job more than them, and therefore they gave way, right? Events overtook them. But at the moment, with this prime minister, he this morning was given an interview at the G7 summit in Bavaria, where he said that he thinks the issue is settled with his leadership, and he sees that confidence vote as a mandate to continue. And although lots of people disagree with him in that, I don't see anyone else with the same kind of animal appetite for the top job that he's got at the moment.
Steve, it's really interesting that point about he wants it more than anyone else actually matters so much in politics. Really good to speak to us. Stephen Swin for the political editor of The Times, joining us live from Westminster as we play you voiced up clips of what MPs have been telling me and Steve over the weekend off the record. It's bringing a real sense of what's going on inside the Tory party. But as I was saying at the top of the big thing, other prime ministers have vowed to go on and on before. And it hasn't always panned out particularly well for them. Well, one person who's seen, I think I count up possibly 9 prime ministers come and go over the years. It's Philip Webster, former political editor of The Times, who joins me now. Hi, Phil.
Hi there. Hi.
You were obviously very, very, very young when you started working in Parliament and covering what was going on in the House of Commons. Putting it into some historical context, this, Boris Johnson's position, and once you get to the point of I'm going to go on and on and on and on, and that might actually count against you rather than in your favour.
Yeah, I remember in Thatcher's case, she said just that, I go on and on. But in her case, it was so different. There was somebody who wanted her job and was openly challenging for it. That was Michael Heseltine. He challenged her, and she didn't get the required number of votes. And when the cabinet went in day by day, or hour by hour, to see Margaret Thatcher and to say, look, if you stand again in that second round, they could say to her, you'll lose and Michael Heseltine will win. And the last thing she wanted at that point in her life was for Michael Heseltine to succeed. It didn't really matter who else succeeded, but she didn't want Michael Heseltine. And she knew that it would be Douglas Hurd or John Major if it wasn't Heseltine, and she didn't really care, provided it wasn't Heseltine. And because Heseltine's action then is a lesson for these cabinet ministers we've been talking about this morning, because he who wields the dagger never wears the crown, and that happened in Heseltine's case. And it must be the case that the people we've been mentioning this morning, the Sunaks, the Trusses, the Wallaces, the Zahawis, they haven't put their head above the parapet, as clearly Dowden hoped on Friday somebody might, because they are being, they fear being seen as the assassin. And Heseltine was the assassin. He ended up as Deputy Prime Minister to John Major, but that was not the job he wanted.
But is that, is it because it's just such a good phrase, he who wears the crown, he who wields the knife doesn't wear the crown, that it's taken on sort of disproportionate importance? Because there are other cases of wielding the knife, or at least moving against the leader, does work in your favour.
Yes.
You know, actually, Gordon Brown, you could argue. I mean, it took him a long time, but he wielded the
knife.
It took
him 13 years.
It took him a blooming long time. Yeah. But he did get there in the end. I mean, Margaret Thatcher, you know, moving against Ted Heath. And actually, there is a risk of if you take the phrase too, and Michael Heston made it up, I think, but that he wields the knife, doesn't wear the crown. You know, you could end up in a sort of David Miliband situation, the Nerley man. He didn't wield the knife against Gordon Brown when lots of people had wanted him to, and now he's not even in politics. There's a counter argument for saying that a lack of caution could be damaging these people.
Absolutely. I think it was either Heseltine or Shakespeare who came up with that map. I'm not sure, but
I think it sounds Shakespeare, but actually it is just Heseltine. But anyway,
but you're quite right. And I mean, I know Oliver Dowden didn't consult with anybody, and he said he didn't consult with anybody, but he clearly was expecting somebody to pick up the mantle on Friday, and it was open to anybody to do it at that point. I must say, I was half expecting somebody to come out of the woodwork. And the counter argument is that if you're first out of the traps in this situation, you might actually get the reward, because there are five or six sort of pretty nondescript candidates out there at the moment. The one who goes first may well be the one who gets rewarded because they've shown a bit of courage. Tory MPs, as you've revealed this morning with some of your the comments that you've disclosed, they are fed up with the cabinet at the moment. The cabinet is not showing; it's a supine cabinet. It's showing no kind of strength at all. The cabinet in Thatcher's day in 1990, when you look at the names in that cabinet, they were pretty strong figures. And when she heard from them, "Look, Margaret, you're going to lose," she took notice. And they do need a bit of backbone in that cabinet if they are going to get rid of Boris before the next election.
Just funny, Phil, because it was you who did the... Let's go back to that summer of 2006. Swirling speculation. It was only a year after Blair had won that election. Swirling speculation about, you know, people saying he needed to set a date and he couldn't go on and on and on. And he calls you in to check us. And you sit down with him to do an interview in which you were basically trying desperately to get him to set a date and he just wouldn't.
That's right. I sat down with him and I asked him 10 times, have you got something to tell me, Prime Minister? There's a lot of stuff about you going before the announcing at conference that this conference would be your last. And he kept looking at me quizzically and saying, so where did you get all that from? And I kept coming back. I kept coming back because I knew he had something in mind. But what I didn't know was that he'd seen Peter Mandelson, various other close allies that morning, just before my interview. They'd gone out of Chequers by the back door, apparently, as me and the photographer came in from the front. I didn't know about this. They'd steeled his resolve for the purpose of that interview. But as we know, it was less than a week because the Brownites went completely mad when my story dropped that night and had their Balti House plot in Birmingham. Within 5 or 6 days, he had indeed to announce that he was going, and the next conference a few weeks later would be his last.
So all we need is a group of Tory MPs and ministerial aides to head to that was it called Bill Shander, the Curry House in Birmingham. They need to go. Yeah. They need to go and plot somewhere properly.
Well, that's why they've rather messed up this time round. There clearly was the absence of proper plotting. And you could say that showed the strength of feeling on the back benches, that 148, without any kind of organisation, voted to get rid of him. But had there been a modicum of plotting, had they arranged for several ministers not to be around, or several ministers, you know, to fall over on the way to the Commons, they could have got rid of him that time round. And if there is a second vote, as Stephen was saying this morning, if there is a second vote of confidence, it's absolutely pointless holding it unless they're sure in advance that they've got, say, 30 ministers on board who will either not vote or come across in the secrecy of the ballot box.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.